I was born, I gave a talk on enlightenment and how to become enlightened. I hope it works. That was like an overview of what Buddhism is and what it's teaching and where it leads to. And of course, such an overview takes a long time, sometimes many lifetimes, to realize. Again, sometimes that when I give an overview, or when a monk gives an overview of Buddhism like that, sometimes it does come across as a bit intellectual or words. It does need to be explained that what one describes here is one describing like experiences. And experiences, they have to be described in words, in concepts. But please do not forget that everything which is described has a meaning, has a heart to it. Whether it's a practice of virtue, whether it's a practice of concentration, meditation, or the arising of wisdom. These are all experiences which can be realized by every individual. And once one realizes these, one explains them in one's own words, using ideas, using concepts. But this path of Buddhism doesn't stop just on the intellectual level, with just words and concepts. In fact, it does rely a lot upon the emotional world. I have noticed in my experience in teaching meditation, a little general rule, it may be appear sexist to you, but I've noticed that it seems that women do have an easier time attaining concentration, whereas males have an easier time gaining wisdom. And just a general feature from my own experience, it may be that my experience is limited, I don't know, but it seems to be a point behind that. In order to actually concentrate the mind, one has to be very well in touch with the emotional world. To gain wisdom, one has to have a very clear mind and clear way of deducing what certain things mean. But I want to go this evening to this emotional world as a preparation for meditation. Not just a preparation for meditation, but as a clearing away of problems in one's life. The Buddha did once say that the ground or the basic prerequisite for attaining concentration is this happy, easeful state of mind. This happy, easeful state of mind, again, is a feeling, is an emotion, it's a state of being inside the mind, inside the heart. A state of well-being. Again, I've noticed that those people who have a devotional heart to them, again, find it very easy to concentrate. Those people have a lot of joy in their heart, a lot of happiness, have an easy time to meditate and to become peaceful and concentrated. Those people who develop loving kindness have an easy time to meditate, to become still. Those people with critical minds, fault-finding minds, have a hard time to meditate. Those people who think a lot and philosophize have a hard time to meditate. So if we wish to calm the mind down, make it very peaceful, we have to come to terms with our inner world, especially with our emotions. And to develop those emotions which are beneficial to us, and to somehow overcome or sidestep those emotions which create problems in our life. And again, in our life, if we wish to follow this Buddhist path, to practice virtue, to gain a concentration, to establish wisdom so that we can become liberated, so we can actually become these enlightened beings I was talking about last week. If we want to do this, we have to develop the heart as well as developing the head. We have to get rid of the problems, the basic problems which stand in the way of even concentrating. These are problems which every one of us are aware of in our lives. They're problems of anger, problems of criticizing, complaining, problems of fear, problems of... they're just endless. So when we look at these problems, we have to find a way out of them. Find a way to remove them. Find a way to clear the path so we can walk upon it without any obstruction. And when we're clearing this path so that we can start to meditate, the beginnings of this whole path of practice, we have to have some incentive to do something about our lives, to clear up the problems. A lot of times that incentive only comes when the problems get so great, the emotional world becomes so unbearable, that we finally decide to do something about it. And the incentive is just great suffering. And then we realize that these things are problems, these things are something we should be dealing with. Whether it is getting angry so often, feeling fed up, having a low self-esteem, all of these things one realizes are a problem to one's basic happiness in life, and certainly are a problem and an obstacle to one's success in meditation. You try meditating when you're angry or when you're upset. It's almost impossible to gain any peace at all. You try and meditate when you've got this fault-finding mind. It's almost impossible to become peaceful, to become still, to get joy in the heart. And so we have to realize these things, when taken to an excess, certainly are problems. Whether it's fault-finding, whether it's anger, complaining, criticizing, getting into conflict, being too aggressive, these things are problems to our life and certainly problems to meditation. We have to do something about them. The incentive comes when we realize they're problems. If we haven't got any incentive, then of course we won't even try to look for solutions. We'll think that it's natural to be angry, it's natural to be fault-finding. What's wrong with being fault-finding? What's wrong with complaining? Is everything wrong in the world? What does it feel like in your heart when you're angry? What does it feel like in your heart when you're complaining? What does it feel like in your heart when there's nothing in the world you can respect or look up to as being really worthwhile? What it feels like is what we call like suffering. It's not a very pleasant state to be in. Please realize what it feels like whenever you're angry, whenever you complain, whenever you find fault with something. Feel what it's like inside, and then perhaps you'll have an incentive to do something about it. Once one has the incentive, there are many what we call skillful means in order to overcome those obstacles to our happiness here and now, and our obstacles to that happy state of mind which can lead to meditation. The skillful means, which are talked about, which are written about at length in Buddhism. These are the how-to, the tricks of the trade. With fault-finding mentality, one can realize, if one looks long enough, that it's no more than a habit of the mind. It's one way of looking at life, not necessarily true. When we have a fault-finding mentality, it looks to us that it is true. When we look for faults, we can always see them. And there is no end to the faults we can find in ourselves, in other people, in the society we live in our friends. Everywhere we look, we see faults, if that is our state of mind. I like to give the story, many of you have heard it, of when we first started building our monastery at Serpentine. And when we first started building our monastery, I was involved very heavily with the building work. I was involved in the building work because at that time we were very heavily in debt. We couldn't afford to employ anyone. And so the monks were the builders. I had to learn from scratch how to mix concrete, how to lay bricks, how to do plumbing, how to do electric work, how to put on a roof. Just the whole works from the beginning to the end. What was interesting, I found, was when I started to learn how to lay bricks. Because as many people have found, when they try to build a barbecue or a small wall, it looks very easy, but it's very difficult. The bricks seem to have a mind of their own, and even though you lay them exactly flat, when you turn around, somehow they move. And every time I found that the brick was out of line, I would remove it and start again. I was a perfectionist. And so I'd finish off my wall, and even though all the bricks which were wrong I would remove, there'd be one or two bricks would slip from my attention. And when the mortar was dry and other bricks were around them, on top of them, beside them, when I could not remove them, I saw there was one or two bricks which were not level. which were actually quite an acute angle. Instead of being horizontal, they were about 30 degrees from the horizontal. And whenever I saw that, I became embarrassed, ashamed of this wall I had laid. When we first built the monastery, we used to have quite a few visitors come along, and we used to take them to see what we were doing in our monastery. We'd take them to some of the buildings. I would always make sure I took them to somewhere else, not the building with the two bricks which were wrong, because I was embarrassed, I was ashamed. Sooner or later, some people came to the monastery, and I took them around, and they saw that wall with the two bricks which were wrong, and they said, "Who built that wall? That's nice." And I had to say to them, "Can't you see those bricks which are wrong?" And they said, "Yes, we can see those bricks which are wrong, but we can also see the 9,998 other bricks which are perfect." I could never see those other bricks which were perfect. All I would ever see when I looked at that wall were the two bricks which were wrong. It's a strange thing, isn't it? Whenever there's a mistake, when everyone has a fault-finding mentality, one will always see the two bricks which were wrong. One will never see the vast number of other bricks which are perfect. When that happened to me, it was like an insight into one of the skillful means. I realized just how the mind works in the way of finding fault. All you need to do, all you need to have is just a small mistake. And every time you look at that thing, that person, that problem, that wall, that's all one would ever see, the mistake. And the way the mind works is it either sees the mistake or it sees the success. It can never, a usual mind can never see both at the same time. And so if it's in the fault-finding mode, the mode which is looking for mistakes, the criticizing mode, it will go to that wall and it will go straight to those two bricks which are wrong. And it won't see anything else. And I realized from my wall that this is not a very just, not a very fair, not a very wise way to look at walls, not a very wise way to look at people, not a very wise way to look at the world. Just this continual fault-finding, criticizing mentality. It's not wise because it gave me a lot of pain every time I went past my wall. I was very ashamed of it. I wanted to get a bulldozer in and sort of knock it over and start again. People had given so much money and I'd made a mess. I'd stuffed it up. Do you ever feel like that about life? Things which you've done? Because all you can ever see is just the two bricks which you've laid wrongly. It wasn't a very wise, a very fair way of looking at life. After that, instead of finding fault with things, I would notice his faults, but I'd also look about what was right with things as well. Whether it was with a person, whether it was with the monastery I was with, whether it was with life, whether it was with myself. Instead of just looking at what was wrong, I'd take the time to deliberately ask myself, yes, but what's right as well? Some years ago, I remember visiting my family in London. As I was walking down the road, I saw two young men, probably about in their early 20s, who were waiting for a bus by the side of the road. There was a garden wall, which was only about, say, 3 feet high, very convenient for sitting on. But the garden wall, instead of being flat on the top, it was curved and rounded. And they were complaining. They were saying, "Why do they make the wall like this? They should make it flat so it's easy for us to sit on." It was someone's garden wall. It wasn't a bus stop. But some people's minds are such that they'd always be finding fault, no matter where they are, no matter what they were doing. Again, some time ago, I was travelling on a bus in Perth, sitting behind, again, two school children, maybe 14, 15, just got out of school, listening to their conversation, who was complaining, putting down, saying what was wrong with themselves, with school, with life. A very unfair way to look upon life, but not just unfair, but also very producive of suffering, of depression. Life is not good enough. School is not good enough. Life is awful. Life is horrible. It creates depression. It creates frustration, pain inside the heart. So much so that sometimes people believe it and go and kill themselves even. Because one has this fault-finding mentality. Okay, the wise way of going about this is to see both the faults and the good, to see both. When one sees the both, one has this wonderful sense of like equanimity, the sense of peace, the sense of, this is life, and there's nothing wrong. There's nothing which needs to be changed. My wall actually is quite all right. It's been there for many years. It manages to keep out the elements from the building. It keeps the roof up. That's good enough. Also, when we forgive the faults and we look for what is good, it brings us happiness and joy inside of our hearts. It makes life easier to live. It makes life more enjoyable. We actually develop what we call in Buddhism, what we call in life, gratitude. And gratitude is completely opposite than fault-finding. Gratitude sees what is right with the world, sees what is right with the other person one is living with, sees what is right with oneself, and says, thank you. Marvellous. What a wonderful thing this is to be in a country like Australia. What a wonderful thing it is to be in Perth. What a wonderful thing it is to be in the Buddhist Society. What a wonderful thing it is to be in this hall here. Okay, this dog's outside. Someone should fix up that dog. Call the council. Someone go outside and shoot it. Someone do this. Someone do that. What does that feel like when we're in that sort of mood? And what does it feel like when we say, well, it's not that loud outside, the dog, it's a long way away, and we can still sit here, we can hear the talk, we can still meditate, we can still become peaceful and silent. It could be better, but this is pretty good. You should have been here when we were in Magnolia Street years ago, in our first centre. I remember once giving a talk there, or actually listening to a talk, in the back garden, because it was too hot inside the house in the summertime. And as the monk who was giving a talk in the back garden, the fellow next door decided to mow the lawn. And no one could hear the talk at all. Now what happens when we start to develop this like a positive state of mind? It brings joy to the heart. And it brings a state of acceptance for the time being. And it brings a state where we can actually meditate and become peaceful. If there's complaining, there's something to be done. There's something to be fixed up. There's work to be done. If we have a sense of gratitude and acceptance, we can leave the faults for the time being. And we can rest. We can be at peace. We can enjoy the moment. If we're complaining, we can never enjoy the moment. Some people have got such complaining minds that they're always busy, always need to fix things up. Always things to be done at home, to be done at work, to be done in the garden. Fixing up the partner you're living with, fixing up yourself. Whenever can there be rest? Whenever can there be peace? Whenever can there be stillness? There can never be that. There's so many things to be done in the world. True, there's things to be done, but there's also time to rest as well. The gratitude gives one the opportunity to stop, to realize that there is much good in this world, there's much good in one's life, there's much peace already here in the heart. One can rest, one can stop, one can be at peace, one can enjoy. Without that gratitude, without that turning away from criticism, one cannot live with oneself, one cannot live with other people, one cannot live anywhere. One will always be on the move. No place will be good enough for you. No person will be good enough for you. Even yourself won't be good enough for you. You'll always be running away. In my monastic life, quite early on, somebody told me this, and I made a resolution very early on when I was a monk that I won't ask to go anywhere. I won't ask to go to another monastery. If I'm sent anywhere, then okay, I'll go, but I'll never initiate where I'm going to stay. Even coming here over 11 years ago, I never asked to come here. And because I haven't asked, I'm still here. But the advantage of that is that there are times when you don't want to be here. The times when you want to be somewhere else. The times when you want to run away. Everyone has those times. Now maybe you might be experiencing that now in your life, in your job, wherever you are. I just want to run away. I can't stand this any longer. Stay. Don't run away too easily. Stay. Stay, stay, stay. And you'll find the desire you want to run away actually leaves you. If you run away every time you're unhappy, that becomes your habitual response. You never learn anything. You never learn that the desire to run away, that fault finding, actually changes and disappears after a while. Because you cannot stand that wall, those two bricks, that if you have to sit in front of it and look at it every day, sooner or later you see that there's other bricks there as well. One of my favourite stories is of these two families, two couples, who went for a cruise from Australia. I think they were actually heading for Canada. In the middle of some great ocean, there was no wind, and also their engine packed up. They were stranded in the middle of this huge body of water. On the deck they couldn't see land in any direction, and the engine had packed up. The two men went downstairs to fix up the engine while the two girls were on the deck. In the heat of the engine room, being frustrated, not being able to fix up the engine, the motor, the two men got into an argument. And the argument got worse and worse and worse. And so they were shouting at one another, brandishing their wrenches at one another. Eventually, one fellow said, "That's it, I'm leaving." When one is angry and mad, one loses all sense of intelligence. And this fellow washed his hands, cleaned up, packed his bags, and actually appeared on the deck with his suitcase. And the two ladies just couldn't believe just the ridiculousness of the situation. There was no land in sight. And they just broke up laughing. And the man, seeing that laughter, realized his stupidity. And he went down to his cabin, unpacked his bag again, put on his work clothes, and went down and help fix up the engine. There was no place to escape. No place to go. How often that is in life, really, there's no place we can go. If we really think of ourselves as being on a boat in the middle of an ocean, with no place to go, we've run away so many times. Instead of running away, we go down to the problem. We face it. We learn to deal with it. We overcome it. The times in the monastery, this monastery, other monasteries, well, I can't stand it any longer, I'm going. Instead of going, I stood my ground and worked it through, worked it out, see what we could do. I've noticed all the time that thought, that feeling inside my mind, I want to go, I can't stand this any longer. It has always been a very biased, one-sided state of mind I've been in. I've just seen a few faults. And I've had no sense of gratitude at all, no sense of appreciation for everything, all the other things which I've had. When we only see faults and we have no appreciation, we'll always be on the move. Never at rest, never at peace. When we're always on the move, we can never gain that peace of meditation. So by stopping, by standing still, by standing our ground, and instead of running away, by working through the problems, especially by getting a wider, more balanced view of the problem, we actually develop the appreciation for the good bricks in the wall, the appreciation for the good things in the person I'm living with, the appreciation for the job I'm working at, the appreciation of the monastery I'm in. Whence one can develop that skillful means, one can live anywhere. One can be at peace anywhere. The external situation isn't so important anymore. And most importantly, if one can live in any monastery, one can live with oneself. Because living with oneself is just the same. There's parts of oneself I can't stand any longer. I want to get rid of this. I want to run away. And I was talking about a yacht in the middle of the ocean. Here's the yacht. Your heart, and it's in the middle of the ocean. There's no place you can run. These things inside of you which you can't stand, which you're upset about, which you don't like, eventually you can pack your bags and think you're going to go up the deck and go somewhere else. Eventually you have to go back down the engine room of your heart and work them out. Find a solution. how one can be peaceful inside. Not running away, but facing up. Sometimes people say that becoming a monk is just running away. Come to the monastery, sit meditation there for a week, 2 weeks, a year, 5 years. There's no running away. In fact, in a monastery, there's just so little escape that you have to face up to yourself, to your desires, to your aversions, to the quirks of your personality, to your whole emotional world. There's no escape anymore. So we face up, we deal with some of these skillful means. Again, the first skillful means is not running away, but looking, seeing, investigating, and then balancing the mind. When we start to do this, when we start to stop that fault-finding mentality, you start to develop like what we call like kind speech. Unkind speech comes from the unkind heart. The fault-finding speech comes from the fault-finding heart. And again, I've noticed that speech is by far the most, the greatest cause of like pain, disharmony, problems with human beings these days. In Australia anyway, we don't go around killing one another with machine guns or with mortars. But we can still cause much pain and much suffering by the way we speak to one another. Again, when we speak, how often do we use fault-finding words? And how often do we use words of appreciation? When we're always using fault-finding words, what does the other person hear? When you hear fault-finding words, what do you hear? And what does it feel like? In your emotional world inside, what's it like when someone tells you off, when they put you down, when they find fault with you? And what's it like when someone actually appreciates you, praises you, says thank you? Which one would you prefer to receive? Knowing which one you prefer to receive, let that be what you give to others. Just noticing the way people speak, we do criticize much more than we ever praise. If you want to find that out, just listen to somebody else, the way they speak. And remember in your heart, remember rather, how much praise they give and how much fault-finding they give. And you'll find that praise is really rare in this world, and fault-finding is a common way we use our speech. No wonder people find it hard to live with one another. No wonder they find it hard to live with themselves, when the way we speak to others becomes the way we speak to ourselves. As we speak to others, that's the way we think to ourselves as well. I've noticed that people with positive attitudes towards others, who do actually appreciate other people, also have a very good relationship to themselves. Those people who are angry towards others, we're always fault-finding, critical, putting another person down. You find out, in being my position as a monk, talking with people, finding out how they're feeling inside, what their problems in life are. In my role as a counsellor, I find out that those people have that very same attitude to themselves. If they're critical to others, they're very critical to themselves. If they're highly critical towards others, they're highly critical to themselves. That same attitude, that same emotional source, shines on themselves just as it shines on others. And what a horrible world that is to live in, which is always fault-finding, always critical, which never praises, never appreciates. That causes a lack of harmony between people. It causes a lack of harmony between oneself. Notice it, and then we can start to do something about it. What we do about it is using wisdom, understanding, to praise a little bit. Realize there is something to praise in there as well. There is something to be grateful of inside. When we realize there's something to be grateful of inside, what we're actually doing is we're starting to practice like loving kindness. Loving kindness is accepting, not criticizing. Okay, sometimes people will say, well, there's so many arguments about accepting. you accept all these people, then just they'll get even worse. People need to be told off. Walls need to be built straight. You can't just have bricks lying any old way when one's building a wall. It might be okay if it's the wall at the monastery, but if it's my house, which I paid $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 for, it's just too much. It's okay to criticize now and again, but also appreciate as well. Find a balance of things which need to be changed and things which need to be accepted. If one hasn't got that balance, then life becomes problematical. Again, from my experience, and maybe I hope that many of you can see this, that our lives are out of balance. There's too much criticism, there's too much anger, there's too much fault-finding, and there's not enough acceptance, there's not enough joy, there's not enough appreciation of what we have. When we practice something like loving-kindness, it is appreciating, accepting. Loving-kindness, appreciation, is working on the emotional world of the human being. All the criticizing comes from the intellectual world. And we do need, as human beings, to also develop the emotional world. Loving-kindness is being able to accept, embrace, no matter what is wrong with the other person. The words which my father told to me as a young boy when he took me aside, he said, I was only 14 at the time, 15, somewhere around that age. He took me aside and said, the door of my house will always be open to you, no matter what you do. Were the words he said. The door of my house will always be open to you, no matter what you do in your life. No matter how I turn out, no matter what I do, good, bad, indifferent, I'd always be his son. He would never shut the door against me. His house was also my house. And that's the words he said. But it meant much more than that to me, as I realized over the years, because it was a statement which he said which stuck in my mind as being something important, something which I wasn't old enough at the time to really appreciate and understand. But as I reflected upon that, kept it in my mind, thought about it, meditated, it became very clear to me that that statement was an expression of what in Buddhism we call undifferentiated, no strings attached, loving kindness. Because what it meant was not just the door of his house would be open to me, no matter what I did, but the door of his heart would always be open to me. And the most important words were, no matter what I did, no matter how I turned out. In other words, his acceptance of me was absolute, was without any criticizing, without any fault-finding, just pure acceptance. The door of my heart always open to you, no matter what you do. At other times he'd tell me off if I did something wrong. He had a balanced heart. But by saying that, by giving me that acceptance, it actually encouraged me to live up to the trust. Whenever anyone does give you what we call undifferentiated loving kindness, full acceptance, no matter what you are, no matter what you do, no matter what you have done, or will do in the future. What that actually does to us as an experience, it inspires so much that we actually want to please that person. If that person has accepted us without any fault-finding mentality, we want to live up to that trust. Now when we say that towards another being, and hopefully we can say that towards another being, the door of my heart is always open to you, no matter what you do, no matter what you have done or will do in the future, which is an acceptance without any strings. It's an expression of pure love, pure loving kindness, pure metta in the Buddhist terminology. And the result of that, it brings happiness towards the other person and happiness towards oneself. One can let the other person in. Not only can one say that to another person, but one can say that to the situation one is in. The door of my heart is open to you, no matter how you are at the moment. Even if one, say an extreme example, is in great pain, to be able to say to that pain, the door of my heart is open to you, no matter how much you hurt. Imagine what that does to you. Maybe you think that's a bit hard to do, but sometimes people in extreme pain, when nothing else can work, when they've tried everything else, when their back is against the wall, it's amazing just what the mind, what the heart can actually rise up and do. Sometimes people do that. Instead of fighting the pain, they accept it. They bring it in rather than keep pushing it out. The door of my heart is open to you, no matter what you are like. No matter how unpleasant you feel, come in, pain, you can be. What that actually does when you do something like that is that the pain just disappears straight away. Because the problem with pain is not the physical feeling, it's the rejection of it, the pushing away, the struggling, trying to find a place where that pain isn't. It's running away. If ever one stops running away from pain, the pain disappears. This is an experience which certainly I've had, other people have had in the past. Not only pain, but any other unpleasant situation one finds oneself in. If one can act with loving kindness towards that situation, the door of my heart's open to you, no matter what you're like. This peace comes in the heart. Again, this is an irrational thought, an irrational movement of the mind rather, not a thought. It doesn't start from the head. As soon as you start from the head, you start thinking of all the things, what, if I accept this pain, I don't do anything about it, it's going to get worse, I'm going to die, I'm going to be crippled, I'm going to have terrible problems in the future. If I don't do anything about this situation, it's going to get worse. This is all like the intellectual movements, which is okay, but I'm talking about another type of attitude, another type of response to the situation. That type of response which isn't fault-finding, which isn't pushing away, but which is accepting, which is embracing, which is bringing in rather than pushing away. This is an emotional response, a wise and useful emotional response, because it brings peace and happiness in the heart, it brings harmony with whatever one's experiencing, pleasant or unpleasant, and it brings this wonderful sense of being at ease with the world. It's acceptance rather than pushing away. Again, there's another lovely story I like to tell about this demon who came into this heaven realm. In Buddhism, we also have like heaven realms, they're temporary abidings. It's not like a heaven in Christianity where one goes to one stays in there for the rest of one's time. In this particular heaven realm, there was the abode of the heavenly being. And this heavenly being had friends, courtiers, ministers. This king of this heaven realm happened to be away on business one day when this demon came into the palace, walked straight up the aisle to the throne of the heavenly being and sat down on the chair on the throne. As soon as it sat down on the chair, the throne of the king of this heavenly realm, the other people in that building started to get angry and upset. Get out of here, you don't belong. You shouldn't be in here. And at that, the demon grew an inch bigger. He grew a little bit more ugly. His language got worse. And the smell coming off him got even harder on the nose to bear. At that, the people in the room got even more upset and more angry. Get out of here, if you don't move quickly, you'll be in trouble. At that, the demon grew bigger. Every unkind word, every unkind deed, every unkind thought, the demon grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and the language was more offensive. And they just got angry and angry and angry, and this had been going on for quite a while. And this time the demon was huge, and so ugly, so smelly, and his language was really, really bad, really coarse. And realm came in to the hall. And the reason why he was king was because he was wise. And he was kind. As soon as he saw the demon, he said, "Welcome. Why have you waited so long to come and visit me? Have you had anything to drink yet? Have you had something to eat? Some sandwiches?" Every kind word, every kind deed, every kind thought which the king of this realm gave towards that demon, the demon grew an inch smaller, a little bit less ugly, the smell eased and the language got better. When the other people in the room saw this, they started running around getting sandwiches, getting cushions. Someone gave him a foot massage. Someone got some fans. Someone got him a heater. Every kind act of body, every kind act of speech, every kind act of thought, the demon grew smaller and less offensive. And they were just so kind and courteous. In no time at all, the demon shrunk to his original size. They didn't stop there, they just carried on. And they laid it on so thick with kindness and goodness that the demon eventually shrunk completely away. And that was a story which the Buddha told in the Udana about the demon which vanished away. He said that demon was an anger-eating demon. The more anger you fed it, the worse it got. And can you recognize anger-eating demons in your life? The more anger you give it, the worse it gets. The anger-eating demons are only dealt with through loving-kindness, through acceptance. Come in here, the door of my heart is open to you, no matter how bad you smell, no matter how bad you speak, no matter how ugly you are. The anger-eating demon goes with loving-kindness, with acceptance. Pain is an anger-eating demon. You get angry at pain in your body. Does it get better or does it get worse? Get out of here, you don't belong. How long have I got to stand here? Does it get better or get worse? Pain is an anger-eating demon. There's so many anger-eating demons in this world. It's good to notice some of them. And don't feed them with anger. Feed them with kindness. Feed them with acceptance. And they disappear. When they disappear, what's left but peace, but harmony? This state of mind, which is an emotional state of mind, it's a feeling in the heart rather than the thought of ease, peace, stillness, happiness, contentment. When one is content, then one can watch the breath. When one is content, then one can still the mind. When one is content, one can make the mind so clear that one can start to see the way things really are. We do need to develop the heart, first of all. We do need to find ways of overcoming the fault-finding, critical, angry mentality inside of us. Sometimes people think, "Ah, yes, great." And they only act when the anger is there in their heart. When the anger arises, now I'll do something about it. When the fault-finding arises, now I'll do something about it. Once a sickness is there, there's little one can do about it. In order to avoid anger, to avoid fault-finding, to avoid this critical state of mind, one has got to work when the mind is feeling reasonably at ease. Once one is in the fault-finding mood, one can never do this practice of loving-kindness, forgiveness, acceptance. One needs to stand back, first of all. One needs to be apart from this rut inside the mind before one can see it. If one has got a stone in front of one's eye, it looks like a mountain. And one cannot see beyond it. One cannot see around it. It's right in front of one's eye. If one can take that stone and put it 10 meters in front of you, you can see it's only a stone. It's not such a big thing. One can see around it. One can see other things. If one has got anger in one's mind, it's like having a stone right in front of one's eye. if one has got fault-finding, critical state of mind, it's right in front of one's eye, one cannot see anything else. One needs to develop the states of kindness, acceptance, appreciation, when the faults aren't very evident, when things are going well in one's life, when the object or the reason for one's anger, rejection, is not right in front of one. To develop loving kindness, develop acceptance, appreciation. Do it on those quiet moments when, if you like, one thinks one doesn't need it. When one is already feeling quite good and quite happy, quite at peace. That is the time to develop appreciation. For example, if it's someone you're living with, someone you know, your enemy, when they're right in front of you, it's very hard to exercise forgiveness. It's very hard to exercise appreciation when they're right in front of you. All you see is their faults. They're too close. But when one is away, when one is apart, when the source of the anger, the source of the fault-finding, the source of the criticism is away from you, and you're feeling in a reasonably easeful state of mind, a reasonable good mind, then think of them. If one is trying to love one's enemies, whether those enemies are people or whether those are things, it's much easier when they're not around. Then to develop kind thoughts, kind words, appreciation, then to be able to say to them, when they're at a distance, the door of my heart is always open to you. As they say in the Chinese proverb, love the tiger, but at a distance. If it's at a distance, it's much easier. And once one builds up that resource of appreciation, the attitude of the mind, which can accept, which can appreciate, then one will find when that person is there before you, it's just so much easier to establish that mood in the mind. It's like a person training to play sports. You have to do the push-ups, you have to do the training, you have to exercise the body, so that when the game is actually on and played, you have trained yourself, you're prepared, you're ready. You cannot train on the football field. There's too many other things going on then. Train at home, train away from the problem. And then when you face a problem, you'll be prepared. And you'll be able to deal with what needs to be done. As they say in another Chinese proverb, instead of complaining about darkness, light a candle. And that's a proverb which I always remember, because so often again, complaining mind means that we're not doing anything. We're just moaning, we're just complaining, we're just criticizing. It makes the matters worse. It never makes any light when we complain about darkness. But we can always light a candle. A candle may not create more than just a small area of light around the wick. But that's something. We're starting. We're getting there. Rather light a candle to complain about darkness. And that means that we're going in the right direction. As far as Ajahn Chah was concerned, he said about complaining, it's, I think I said this not so long ago even, I can't stop now, it's like having an itch on the head and scratching the bottom. That's what complaining is like. Because the problem never goes away. The problem isn't with the other person, isn't with the situation, isn't with what's outside of you, it's inside us, in here. If the itch is on the head, that's where you've got to scratch. You can't scratch elsewhere and think the problem's going to go away. So we look inside of our hearts and see what is stopping us being peaceful. What is stopping us feeling joy inside of the heart. What is stopping us having this happy state of mind, which in Buddhism we need to develop so that meditation combined, so we can become peaceful, we can become concentrated. Whether that happy state of mind is developed through practicing loving kindness, whether it's practiced through developing this appreciation, this devotional, positive attitude towards what one is experiencing, However it is developed, we do need to develop the emotional world as well as the intellectual criticizing world. It's so easy to find fault. It's so easy to destroy, which is what finding fault is. It's so easy to get a bomb and blow up this hall. It only takes a few seconds. But for those people who have been involved in building this hall, you know how many years it has taken to put this together. You look upon it, it's too hot. Not big enough. Not the right shape. This is wrong, that is wrong. It's so easy, isn't it, to pull down. It's so hard to build up. Think of that when you're talking to people. All that they've done, it's so hard to do anything. And it's so easy to criticize. If we can only develop gratitude and a sense of acceptance more, then people will be more willing to try and live up to high standards. Praise actually encourages us. I was a school teacher before I became a monk. I remember a story where there was, not a story, it's actually a group of experiments which were done and which are very positive in their results. There's a difference between what they used to call positive reinforcement as a teaching method and negative reinforcement as a teaching method. The negative reinforcement was every time you made a mistake, you were punished. Physically, emotionally, whatever it was, that you were told by the teacher that you'd made a mistake, you'd done it wrong. That was emotional. That was sort of negative reinforcement. The other type was called positive reinforcement. Every time you made a mistake, every time you did something wrong, no one said anything. No one did anything. Every time you did something correct, you did the problem properly, you got it right, the teacher would let you know, give you a hug, give you a present, would give you this positive reinforcement back, say, well done, marvellous, tremendous, great. And even with school children, it was found very quickly, very conclusively, that positive reinforcement, with positive reinforcement, the children learn far quicker. They solve problems much better. They learn faster. With negative reinforcement, the knowledge was gained slowly. And not just slowly, it was gained with resentment as well. Sometimes the people stop learning because they got so fed up with the punishment, so fed up with the negativity of the school. This is with children. How much more would it work with human beings who are adults? Positive reinforcement. If one gives positive reinforcement to someone else, they actually learn the task much quicker. Instead of finding fault with someone when they do something wrong, forgive. Accept. Let it go. When they do something right, praise. Give positive reinforcement back, whether it's a hug, whether it's a thank you, whether it's a present, whatever it is. You'll find that the person will grow in a way which is good, much faster. So you see that criticism, negative reinforcement, putting down this negative state of mind, not only doesn't work very fast, it doesn't produce the results one really wishes it to produce. But it also creates this negativity in the mind, this pain in the mind, this heavy lack of ease inside of our mind. It's not a joyful state of mind to live in. And so, maybe to end this old year, with all the faults which may have been in it, by forgiving, letting go, not carrying anything from the past year into the new year. And in the new year, to try and develop a sense of loving kindness, acceptance. The door of my heart is always open, no matter what I experience. The appreciation of oneself, people one lives with, the circumstances one finds oneself in. Developing positive reinforcement towards oneself and others. Every time that you do a good deed, a kind deed, a generous, warm deed. Praise yourself. Acknowledge it. Give that positive reinforcement. You'll find you will grow. That attitude in the mind will become more and more prevalent inside of you. It's the difference between watering weeds or watering flowers. Watering weeds is criticism. Watering flowers is appreciation and praise. And that will come out in your words and your acts. You'll be someone who acts kindly, generously, warmly. And you'll be someone who doesn't speak harshly, who doesn't act harshly. You'll find yourself fulfilling all of the rules of virtue, whether it's the 5 precepts, 8 precepts, or 227 precepts. Why is it the 5 precepts of a Buddhist are hard to keep? Because if the heart isn't ready. You may will and want to keep the 5 precepts or any rules of virtue, but if the heart isn't ready, one cannot do it. So this is going to the emotional world, the source. Purify the source, purify the heart. Be someone who has appreciation, kindness, goodwill, and who starves the critical mind, who starves the fault-finding mind, and tries another way. It brings happiness to yourself and happiness to others. And that is the way of Buddhism, that which creates happiness for oneself and happiness to others. So I'm going to end this talk this evening about some of the emotional preparations before we actually go on to things like samadhi practice, meditation practice, and insight practice. Just basics of living a happy life. Are there any questions about the talk this evening? Any questions or comments on the talk? Okay, I'll just make an announcement for this evening. Being New Year's Eve, here in the Buddhist Center, as we do every year, we usually stay up, the monks stay up here until midnight when we do some auspicious chanting. To welcome in the new year. So this evening's program, what will happen now is that after we've paid respects to the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, we'll go into the meeting room next door and have a cup of tea and have a chat. At 10 o'clock, you can come back in here, those of you who wish to stay, to do some more meditation. And we can do meditation, maybe for 30 minutes, followed by some walking meditation outside, and then more sitting meditation in here, and then walking meditation. So if we can do 30 minutes sitting, and 30 minutes walking, 30 minutes sitting, 30 minutes walking, until midnight. If you wish to, during that time, have a cup of tea inside the meeting room next door, then please do so. But as you're coming in or going out, please be quiet in here, because we want to try and keep this hall here as a place for meditation between 10 o'clock and just before 12. That way, we'll be bringing in the new year in a very good, noble, useful, purposeful way. We'll be using our time wisely. Again, just to recall, recalled something which a friend of mine, a monk, told me. He was staying with a very well-known in Thailand, a very famous, powerful monk who was an excellent meditator and had psychic powers as well, could read other people's minds. And this American monk, when he was staying with this monk who had the psychic powers, one day when he was meditating, instead of watching the breath, which is what he was supposed to do, he decided to fantasize. He got into this sexual fantasy. And he said that it was very easy to keep his back straight and keep very aware, just thinking about sexuality. And it was only afterwards he thought, oh my dear, what's my teacher going to say? Because he was sure that his teacher could read his mind. And he felt very scared. Now what do you think a teacher would do? Would he find fault? Would he criticize? He was so scared what his teacher would say that when his teacher actually caught him and saw him, all he said was, that's just wasting time. Not putting the fellow down, not sort of criticizing him, but just pointing out that such a thing was just wasting time when you could have been doing something more useful. And so even this evening, between 10 and 12, don't waste time. If one wishes to develop the heart, this is an opportunity for doing some walking meditation, sitting meditation here in the hall. If one finds that it's a bit too much for one, then go and have a cup of tea in the meeting hall. But please keep this area quiet. And at 12 o'clock, we'll be doing the auspicious chanting. Again, so as a symbolic entry into the next year, 1994. So that'll be at 12 o'clock. If you can stay for some of it, or just part of it, you're always welcome. So we can actually pay respects to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha now, and then if you wish, you can go and have a cup of tea, or whatever you need to do. Impermanence. Many new years have gone past in my life. They go past so quickly. And this is always a time when we reflect. We spend just a few moments looking at the past. And we look at our successes and failures in the past year. And when we look at that which we've done, which has succeeded, we don't take it for granted. We remember them, we give ourselves a pat on the back, and we also encourage ourselves to maintain that which we look back upon and feel proud of, feel good at. We maintain those good thoughts, good words, good deeds. We try and improve them, make them even better. And those things we look back upon the past year, which have been our failings, we remember that we're human beings with imperfections. We can expect failures now and again, but by expecting them, by accepting them, we do also try and urge ourselves gently, wisely, to do better next year. It is useful to make resolutions, as long as they're wise resolutions, resolutions which we can actually attain, which we can actually work towards and reach. Not impossible goals, but real goals. And goals which are going to be useful for us and other people in this world. Goals such as being kinder, more gentle, more compassionate, wise beings. Beings who develop more carefulness and mindfulness in the world. Who tread more gently on every step through the year. Treading gently so that we neither hurt ourselves nor hurt others, but that we progress more and more on the path of Buddhism. And we know when we're progressing, when things in our life become more peaceful, more joyful, more easy. Not the ease of laziness, but the ease inside the heart, where our life is less of a burden. The ease of being free from afflictions, liberated from that which causes us suffering, which causes us problems. And at the end of each year, if we can only look back and think, I've tried my best, I've done all that I can, and that indeed that I am just a little bit further on to liberation, a little bit closer to freedom, a little bit nearer to the goal of enlightenment, then we can feel happy, we can feel at ease. And indeed, when it's our last new year, when it's our last day, our last breath in this body, if we can only then look back upon our life and think, I've done the best I can, I've lived a noble, a good, a fine life, a life full of virtue, full of compassion, full of wisdom, then when we look back with that realization, with that knowledge, with that understanding, it brings us great peace and happiness in our heart. Even though we may not have reached the final goal of enlightenment, of nibbana, at least we've made progress, we've done all we can, we've done our best. And that if it's the end of a day, if it's the end of a year, if it's the end of a life, if we can look back with that thought in our mind, it gives us great peace and great happiness. So we look back upon what's gone past, and we look forward to what's going to, we wish to achieve, we wish to attain in the future. And we also look in the present moment. It's in this present moment, the now, when we can actually work, when we can actually perform, when we can actually achieve the goals of our future. When we pass from one year to the next, sometimes we wonder, well, one day is the same as the next. Tomorrow, January the 1st, 1994, is not much different than December the 31st, 1993. But it is different. I hope it's different. We are older, but hopefully we're also wiser. We're also more pure in our hearts. We're more virtuous. We're more clear. We're more wise. Hopefully we are growing in a good way. We're developing, becoming better human beings for our own happiness and the happiness of the world around us. And if we can notice that one day is not the same as the next, but one day is one step closer to the goal, closer to purity, closer to freedom, closer to this happiness we call freedom, then the day is well spent. And this is the reason why we've encouraged each other to come here this evening, so that this last day of the year, when we spent listening to the teachings, doing some chanting earlier on, practicing meditation, having discussions about interesting subjects connected with Buddhism, then we can look back upon the last few hours of 1993 as hours which have been well spent. And when we finish 1993 and go into 1994, it brings us this sense that we haven't wasted our time. We've done that which is worthwhile, done that which is useful. And we know that that will bring happiness in our heart. All that is good, all that is wonderful, which we perform, will have its results, will bring forth its fruits, both now and in future. Every good act, every good deed, every good thought is that which brings us happiness. So what a wonderful way to end one year and begin the next, by doing that which produces happiness. And it's not just happiness for ourselves. This is not a selfish path, because whatever brings happiness in your heart is that which will bring happiness towards other beings. Even a Buddha sat under a tree and became enlightened for his own happiness. For that was the cause for the happiness of untold millions, billions of beings. The kind, good, mindful, wise actions which you've done this evening will bring forth happiness for yourself and also happiness for others. This is why it's a worthwhile thing and a wonderful thing to do for the end of one year and the beginning of a new year. So we remember the path of Buddhism, and we determine that we will practice this path as best we can for our sake and for the sake of the people we live with and for the sake of others. If we look in the world, there is much which causes us disturbance, sorrow, just the amount of pain and suffering in the world. And sometimes there is the feeling inside of us, what can I do about it? How can I help? What can I do to serve or to lessen the pain in human beings and in the animal world and in the natural world of this planet Earth? How can I help? And one of the best ways, one of the most effective ways, and one of the most wonderful ways we can actually do something, we can actually help, is making our own heart pure. If we learn how to live simply, we can learn how to help the planet so that we don't take so many of its resources so quickly. If we can learn how to be kind inside our heart, then we won't create anger, aggression, and violence. We won't encourage that in others if there's kindness in our own heart. If we can develop forgiveness for all those people who have hurt us in the past, all those people who have created problems in our life, if we can forgive, then we can encourage others to also practice that forgiveness. So old feuds can end and old pain can be forgotten, so we can go into the new year with no baggage from the past, not carrying old resentments, old arguments, old differences. And we can be beings like the simile which the Buddha used for the arahats, for the enlightened beings, like swans who glide through the air, very lightly with no baggage, who fly wherever they will, always above and outside and beyond the world, at peace, free. It is now the new year. We're going to now do some auspicious chanting. If you can just sit quietly just for a few more moments as we do this traditional chanting, which is our way of wishing that this next year and the years that follow, all the time in the future, will bring forth happiness and progress in the path of freedom and release. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Karaniyamata kusalena yantang santa padang abhisame ca sakho uju ca suhuju ca suvacho ca samudu anatimani santu sakho ca subhavo ca apakicho ca salahu kavuti santindriyo ca nipako ca agabo kulezo ananukito na ca kudang samachare kinchiyena winyupare upavate yung sukino wa Emino hontu sabbe sata avantu sukhitata ye ke cipana buddhati tasava tavarava anavasesa digava ye mahantava majimava saka anukatula ditava ye cha adita ye cha dure vasanti avidure buddhava sambhave siva sabbe sata bhavantu sukhitata na paro para nikubheta na timanyeta katatinanki Sāyā rūsana pātīka sānyānān yamānyā sadu kamichaya mātā yatāniyāṁ pūtā āyusā eka pūtā manurāke evaṁ pisāpa pūtē sumāna sambhāvaye apharimānāṁ metāṁ ca sāpa lokāsmiṁ māna sambhāvaye apharimānāṁ Uttanga to cha tiriyan cha sampada Awevang asapatang titan cha ra Nisino wa sayano wa Yavata sawigata mito Etang sating aditeya brahma meta viharang idamahutitim cha anupaga silavata sanena sampano kame suvinaya geta Nahi chātu kāpaseya hunareti ti Asevana ca bālānāṁ pānditānāṁ ca sevana Pūca ca pūca niyāna Eta mangala muta mang patiu padesa vasu ca pube ca kata punyata ata samma paniti ca eta mangala muta mang bahu sa chan ca si Pancha vinayo cha susikito subhasita chaya vacha eta mangala mutama mata pitu upatanang putata Anākula ca kāmanta etāma galamutamāṁ dhānaṁ ca dhammacariyā caya takānaṁ ca saṅgaho anavajjanikāma etāmaṁ galamutamāṁ Ārati virati pāpā mājapāna ca sānyamo āpamādo ca dhammesu etā galamuttamaṁ garavo ca nivāto ca santuti Chakatanyutakalenadamasavana etamangalamutama kanti chasovacasatasamanana chadasanankalenadamasakacha Eta mangala muta mangtapo ca brahmachariyan ca ariyasacchanata sananipana sacchikiriya ca eta mangala muta mangputasalo Kadamehi chitang yasana kampati asoka virajang kemang etama Galamutamam putasadam madame ichitanya sanakam patiasoka virachankemang etama Galamutamam etadisanikatawa Sabatama Parasita Sabatasa